The Athletic.
Sam Allardyce has never heard of a Markov chain. Not a chance. But that is a really smart way of using data. Like, we know where the ball goes. Let's put the players there.
Hello and welcome back to the Athletic Football Tactics Podcast. As you know by now, we're interested in football tactics and also in data analytics. I'm Ali Maxwell. Today's episode, perhaps more than ever before, is therefore relevant to our interests. We are reflecting this week on a topic that we are broadly calling, has analytics actually changed the way football is played on the pitch? And to help me with it, I've got two published authors in and around the topic and a man with a PhD. That's you, Mark Carey. How are you doing?
Good, thank you. Yeah, I'm glad to be a part of the inclusion on books. I suppose I've written a thesis that could be included as a book, so maybe include me in the trio.
I've got two.
How many words? How many words is a thesis?
80,000.
Oh, that is quite a lot. Okay. Fair enough.
Sorry, I'm trying to drag myself up here. No, these are established authors. I'm a fraud.
Fair enough, says nice Michael Cox. He loves his tactics. He writes for The Athletic, and he's done a few books himself, to use the technical term. Hello, Michael.
Hi, Ali.
How did you swing this? And I quote from your Twitter feed, for the first time ever, all four Madrid sides had home La Liga games in the same weekend. I went to all four. Rayo, Real, Atletico and Getafe. How did you get a sign-off for that?
Well, it wasn't even a work thing. It was a complete coincidence. A friend of mine was working in Madrid last week and this week. And we had the dates in the diary before the fixtures came out. So when four Madrid fixtures in the same weekend came up, we were jumping for joy. And even better when, you know, they only set the fixtures about 10 days beforehand. So when we realised we could go to all four of them, then it became an article idea. But it was good. I did worry that it was going to read a little bit like a gap year student writing a blog, but people seem to quite enjoy it.
There to be read on the Athletic site once you've listened to this, because with apologies to my two regulars, most excitingly of all, we have Rory Smith, chief soccer correspondent of the New York Times and author of the recently released book, Expected Goals, the story of how data conquered football and changed the game forever. Hi, Rory. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Your book is top of currently the Amazon UK best-selling econometrics charts.
That's exactly where we pitched it. That was the audience we were hoping for. I don't really know what econometrics are, to be perfectly honest.
I didn't really know how to say it, to be honest.
But it's also faring very well in mathematics references, which is, again, just a dream come true. I'm not quite sure how it's doing in football, which feels a bit more relevant, but, you know, beggars can't be choosers.
Well, there's a category called recreational mathematics. You're number three in that at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of recreational maths books out at the moment. People who just love doing maths in their spare time, kind of on trains, when they're just relaxing at home. That is, I mean, it's a competitive field.
Yeah, it certainly is. Well, something to aim for anyway, to reach the top of those and other charts. We've all had a good read. I actually performed quite a modern hybrid reading model for the first time, which was reading it physically and then getting in the car and just finding the spot that I'd left on the audiobook and then listening to that. So it really was, it was very exciting. Did you think
that's an immersive experience?
Yeah, it really was. Did you think about voicing it yourself?
No, I'm from Yorkshire, so that wouldn't appeal to the vast majority of listeners, unfortunately. No, I think these things are best left to professionals, to be honest.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I'm actually looking to get into some of the voiceover work myself. So maybe the next one, I'll send you my CV, which at the moment is just packed with tasteful ad reads. So see how we go. Rory, your book, in your words, was or is about a very quiet revolution in the way that we think and talk about football and the way football thinks about itself and crucially contains zero equations. Was that generally the plan going in, or did things change as you dug deep into the surface, as often is the case with books like this?
Yeah, I think more the latter than the former. That I think I had an idea in my head that there has been a big change in football in the last 15 or 20 years in the way that we look at it, really. I think we have, without really noticing it, shifted the way that we interpret and how kind of open we are to the idea that things can be measured. And I was expecting to find basically a story of football being resistant to that on the inside as this kind of change happened on the outside, and then eventually football's kind of grudgingly through gritted teeth going, all right then, fine, we'll do a bit of this numbers stuff. And I think the picture's probably a bit more nuanced than that, to be honest. I think that football probably doesn't get the credit it deserves for incorporating a lot of these ideas relatively quickly. You've got to bear in mind it's a really kind of atomized industry, and there's very little, like Mark will have experienced this a lot, but there's very little desire to share what you're doing with others. Whereas in baseball, which is always held up as the poster child for kind of analytics revolutions, they do have a much more like collaborative model almost. And I think that maybe this is just a theory, but it comes from the fact that there's a lot of revenue sharing, there's a lot of kind of mutual aid amongst the owners, just it's this closed shop. So they kind of understood the idea intuitively that you can tell everybody else about the stuff that you're doing, and maybe you can even show off a little bit about it. Whereas a lot of what's happened with football has happened very, very quietly. And even the people who have embraced analytics most wholeheartedly don't really want to tell anybody about it. So the most kind of publicity friendly, I guess, are probably Brentford. But if you read through what Brentford will tell you, there's not much detail. And even as a journalist, you obviously, maybe that's a failure of journalism, but Brentford aren't shouting from the rooftops, we're doing this stuff and this is how it works. They'll tell you they're doing the stuff if you asked, but after that it bleeds pretty quickly into kind of nicety and cliche and broad sweep stuff. And partly that is without a sort of wry smile, that is partly a failure of journalism, because it's difficult to convey like sexiness and interest to a public that might be slightly skeptical about things that can feel quite dry. But it's also just the clubs don't want to tell you. There is nothing in it for them to tell you or the general public, or certainly their rivals, anything about what they're doing. And that, I think, has created what is a slightly false impression that football has not done any of this stuff. Whereas I think if you look particularly in the broader sweep of it, there's been a fairly massive shift. But it's such a kind of, it's been so quiet that if you speak to people, Mark, I'm sure will have found this, if you speak to people in clubs, they will tell you that nobody is doing data at all, and they'll definitely tell you that nobody is doing data properly. That even the clubs who kind of, you think might have a little bit of fellow feeling, might appreciate the work that others are doing, will basically sit there and slag each other off, because nobody quite knows what everybody else is up to. And I think that has created this, it's a little bit of an illusion that that change has been slow, whereas I think in reality change has been kind of remarkably quick.
Mm. It's interesting that you bring up Brentford there. I mean, I was sort of nodding along because they have been held up as the data team for some time. And I dare say starting from a position in the Championship might have helped with that, and helped with the wider media, if you will, being sort of happy to have them as the data team. But one of the things they have spoken quite a lot about as part of their success is not just using numbers. It's actually decision-making processes and hiring people at board level or staff members to do things a little bit differently. Again, not always data-driven. You know, even on the pastoral side, they have at least tried new things and kind of broken new ground on that front. And yet, mostly people just want to go, but also they are the data team.
I think that so data doesn't solve anything by itself, and no one in football would tell you that. Like even Brighton, who are probably the most data like puritanical, wouldn't say that everything's about data. I mean, Brentford, the great example is the abolishing the academy. There will have been data of some form used in that decision, but they'll have made it partly because it is a, I think Rasmus Anderson always kind of saw himself as a disruptor. I like Rasmus, but you can definitely see him describing himself as a disruptor, like maybe writing on his business cards. They have thought more and more about how to, not take shortcuts, but to do things differently, to try and find different ways to close the gap. There's this metaphor that loads of people in football use about boats, which is that if you're sailing a boat and you want to overtake the boat in front, you can't follow the same path, I suppose is what you'd call it, even if it's in the water. You have to find a different route. And Brentford are kind of the best example of that in football, I think, that they've looked for different routes to kind of gain speed. Data is part of that. It's not the be-all and end-all of that by any stretch of the imagination. And I think even with, say, Liverpool, it's probably best thought of, this phrase is a little bit dirty now. People don't really like using it. But football is a sport of marginal gains at the elite level. And that could be nutrition. It could be having like the best fitness coach. It could be inverting your fullbacks. It could be having a goalkeeper who can pass the ball 70 yards onto a sixpence, or it could be data. And it's the ability of those teams to find as many of those little edges as possible that gives them the best chance of competing. And I think, yeah, to an extent, what football has done is incorporate data into that whole like set of things that it can do. I'm not sure that any team has fully given itself over to data, but then maybe that's not the revolution that needed to happen.
Mm. Mark, you must have read this with some interest as someone who has been an observer, an enthusiast, and now very much a purveyor of data analytics in football. You know, there was a nice element to it from my point of view of these are people I recognize from following on Twitter and reading the early work of, and then actually I didn't hear much about them because they went to ground within clubs. It was a good read in that sense.
Yeah, I was literally about to say it was great to see so many familiar names in the book and hear their story. But yeah, Roy, I thought it was a great read. It documented that evolution just really well, and obviously it was more of an evolution than a revolution, shall we say. I think that it also documented how many bumps in the road there really were. I'm sure we'll come on to the example of Sarah Rudd as well, of just how much at Arsenal, how much what she wanted to implement was implemented to its full capacity, shall we say. But I still think there's just so many chapters, quite literally, maybe Rory, a second book here, but there's so many chapters within this story as well, because there's so much more that could be gleaned and extracted from data and analytics. So I do feel like while it maybe we're looking at kind of over a period of decades now, I suppose, there's still so much movement to go. So it keeps me in a job.
Yeah, I think it's funny, if I'm doing a thing at the StatsBomb conference next week, I think, which, and the title of the panel is The End of the Beginning. And I think that's probably how I wouldn't pretend to be a data expert and analytics expert in any way, but from kind of researching and reporting the story, it strikes me that the broad conceptual battle's probably been won, and was probably won before people realised it had been won. But now the kind of the next step is to figure out, okay, exactly how powerful is this? And I think in terms of how football is played, there have been certain things that data has helped inform, certain changes, but the big ones are probably still further down the road, I guess.
There's so much to the book that we can't and we won't go through it all. I think we'd need a 24-hour live stream, really, given how much there is to chew on, I suppose. We wanted to start by looking at what we talk about most weeks, and that is football tactics and the impact on data on how the game is played. Michael, this is obviously something that you keep a very close eye on, and we've spoken at length about the ways in which the game has changed over the last 10, 20 years. Having read Rory's book, thinking more specifically about data on that front, kick us off with the discussion. I mean, what's your instinct on how much of an impact data has had on how the current football teams play?
Well, it's interesting because I heard Rory on the Football Clichés podcast with Adam Hurry. We haven't got Rory exclusively, should say. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like when U2 released that album that was on everyone's iPhone, regardless of whether they wanted it. And I thought it was interesting. Adam said something is interesting. There's kind of a traditionalist versus, you know, analytics fans scale. And Rory's probably on the centre of it. And I'd say I'm probably more on the analytics scale. But I thought it was interesting because the subtitle is the story how data conquered football and changed the game forever. And I think it's an excellent argument of how data has conquered football. But I thought it was interesting that I got the impression there aren't that many ways it's completely changed the game. It's changed the way recruitment is done. But I thought in terms of actually football on the pitch, as you said just now, it feels like we're still waiting to see almost the key analytic or the key metric that actually changes how football plays, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I don't know whether there is a key metric. I think when everybody saw Moneyball, because football isn't really a literary industry, it's very much a visual thing. They're kinesthetic learners. I think the message that it kind of gave was that there was OBP in baseball that was the thing they were all overlooking, and that's what led the A's to that winning streak, and therefore there must be the same metric in football. And I think a lot of the people actually who got involved early on, the kind of external enthusiasts, were probably looking for something like that, but it became relatively clear relatively quickly that the chances of that being discovered is is are pretty slim. Like, I think they thought for a while it might be high intensity sprints, that then, you know, if you ran kind of intensively more than your opponent, you'd probably increase your chances of victory, which feels fairly intuitive. But I'm not sure that, partly just players will manipulate it. So there's the stories of, like, Pablo Zabaleta used to shuttle across the pitch at high intensity during breaks in play just to get his stats up. So players will game the system to an extent. But also, like, you can run as hard as you like. If you've got crap players, you're not going to win football matches. So I'm not sure there is a kind of, there's not a magic bullet, I don't think. And yeah, you're right that in terms of kind of the nature of football, I think data has had an impact, but it's an impact that's acted in concert with other stuff. So it's hard to say exactly, right, that is a data thing. I think more that it's changed the way the game operates. And the crucial thing with that, away from kind of on the pitch, is I think it's changed who gets to work in football. And that is a massive shift, because that has never been, you know, you've got Tom Warville at RB Leipzig. That doesn't happen before. That would be complete anathema. I think there was a team in Brazil once that appointed a journalist as a joke to be manager, because he was criticising from the sidelines, and they were like, all right, then you have a go. And predictably, he was terrible. But if you look at kind of quite a lot of staffing levels, both among the elite and lower down, there are people in football with a non-traditional background. And that, for football, is a huge... That was heresy until relatively recently. I think in terms of how the game works tactically, how it works on the pitch, there's two very obvious things that I think have changed, and that's long shots and crosses that are influenced by data. But no, I think the game's development has probably been broadly on the pitch, broadly the same as it would have been, maybe even if data didn't exist, if that's a sentence that makes any sense.
Yeah, no, completely. But it's interesting because the last 15 years or so, which I think is roughly the analytics era, football has changed massively in terms of the short passing, in terms of, you know, I think it all stems essentially from Guardiola's influence at Barcelona. I think that was the catalyst for what's happened since. And I think the data probably does support that. And you're very honest about, there's a line in the book where you say, it makes it difficult to say with absolute certainty which elements of elite football in its current form can be traced back to data. Did you just find a reluctance from people to explain the processes that had changed decision-making? Because, for example, to mention Sarah Rudd again, I remember when I first saw her blog about Markov chains, which was kind of tracing things back from goals and what players did and how you get to that point. I was like, well, that almost not solves football, but it is going to explain so much about how you work the ball from back to front. But are people just reluctant to say precisely how the data has had an impact on their team's playing?
I think even the teams that are relatively open about the fact that they are using data widely don't want to credit data specifically as the source of whatever it is they do. So if you look at, say, Liverpool appointing the throw-in coach, that will be a decision that was supported by data, but it feeds into Jurgen Klopp's general belief in delegation, in hiring experts, in what we used to call marginal gains. As I say, I'm not sure you're allowed to say that anymore. There will be data at the heart of that. And what they noticed was, look, throw-ins are actually quite important. There's loads of them in a game. We need to be better at them. We need to keep possession more from the ones that we get, and we need to win possession back more from the ones that we concede. So that is a data-driven insight, I guess, into, right, this is a form of inefficiency. Let's get better at it. Let's make it more efficient. But in terms of the broader stuff, I think the problem is that partly it's hard for them to separate what is specifically something they've noticed in the data or something they want to investigate because of the data, and what is something that they just sort of feel, and then they look at the data and they think, okay, yeah, maybe we've got something here. And the other thing is that it's political. So if you think about that Guardiola style of play, and I broadly agree with you that's the defining kind of stylistic change in football is what Guardiola showed to be possible, and that's where a lot of these ideas, the philosophical concepts, stem from. I think most teams will have looked at some of the things he does and looked at the data to see if there is sense in doing it, if there is a sort of data explanation almost for the success that he's having. And they will have tried to ape some of them. But people won't necessarily want to say, well, that's because of the data. They might want to say, we've got a really good coach, or this is because of our midfielders. They don't want to necessarily take the credit away from the humans involved and hand it to what's perceived as the algorithms. And I think that it's partly explains the relative reticence to say this is a data thing that we are doing. There's an element of not wanting to give your secrets away, but also people want to take credit for ideas. They don't want to sort of hand it over to an overarching principal. And I think that muddies the waters a little bit.
And also presumably the fact that from data insight, light bulb moment to we score a goal doing this, there's a very long journey. and the journey isn't program robots to do that. It's way more complicated than that. And perhaps crucially to this whole discussion, and as you've alluded to there, it involves many human beings, their egos, their brains.
Well, yeah, and that's crucial in both in terms of why data has struggled a little bit to gain acceptance in certain clubs and why it succeeded. So there's an example in the book of Sam Allardyce, who's the kind of unsung hero of modern football, which is not a comfortable sentence to say. But so Allardyce obviously led part of the sports science revolution and deserves a lot of credit for that. But he was also an early adopter of relatively sophisticated analytics and finding practical kind of ways of implementing them. And one of the things that he does in the late 90s is looked at corners and worked out they're a cheap source of goals. So he thinks, right, we need to get as many corners as possible. And then he kind of, and this is what's relatively impressive about Allardyce, is that he then moves it on and thinks, right, how can we ask supplementary questions of that insight, that basic insight that we have? And you end up with him not only working out whether in-swingers or out-swingers lead to more chances, but where to put players on the pitch for when the ball is cleared from a corner, which is actually, and Mark will be speaking to people who do way more sophisticated stuff than that now. Sam Allardyce has never heard of a Markov chain. Not a chance. But that is a really smart and very kind of, yeah, very, very insightful way of using data. Right, we know where the ball goes. Let's put the players there. But even from that insight, you still need Youri Zhurkaev to put the ball in and Kevin Davis to head it home. The data itself isn't the solution. You need to have the right players in place to kind of make the whole plan work. And that makes it hard to say this is a data thing, because how many of those Bolton goals were scored because of data? Probably a proportion. How many of them were scored because Kevin Davis knew how to use his elbows? Also probably a proportion.
I'm pretty sure that actually, you know, that set piece corner routine that was popularized as the love train, with England's defenders lining up in a row to attack the cross. I actually think Allardyce called that the Markov chain when he was at Bolton at the time. That was one of their routines. Mark, do you feel instinctively that shot locations, crossing towards heads, and set pieces and the understanding of their value, are those three of the sort of most obvious answers here, if we're trying to find ways in which increased data analysis has changed the way teams play, how they operate?
Yeah, I'd say so. I think in everything that Rory and Michael have said, it does seem to be that there's more kind of case studies rather than an overall kind of tactical trend. And those that you mentioned, Ali, I think would go in that category. I mean, I did a piece midway through last season, so it was looking then back in the previous decade from there. So it started in 2011-12 and then went to the 2020-21 season and looked at the shot locations and the percentage of shots that were taken outside the penalty area. And you can see a clear trend, but kind of as the guys are saying, it's really difficult to then infer that causality. So it was 47% of shots were taken outside the penalty area in 2011-12, and then by 2020-21 season, that was down to 37%. And there was a clear trend going down. But as I say, you don't know whether that is because of the tacticians who have graced the Premier League and just learning to work the ball into more lucrative areas, or it is, let's look at XG and XG per shot. And we know that the higher the XG per shot, the more likely you are to score. So let's get closer to goal. So as that, for example, you don't know whether it's one or the other. But I think just more broadly, I think it's an interesting point of how reluctant maybe the data people are within clubs to sort of take any sort of credit for it, because it might be that they, as you say, there's so many different elements along the production line where they might not necessarily provide any data to the coaching staff. They have maybe gone away, done a research project, built a statistical model, and all of their work from a period of weeks or months actually just goes to saying something along the lines of, we attack more down the left, but we have more threat coming from the right. Something that's really grounded in a statistical model that they can safely come to that conclusion, but what is just a footballing language, a sentence. If you kind of get what I mean, that you don't know whether it actually does have that causality from what is the data or just something that is already happening. So maybe that's why the data people within the clubs are a bit reluctant to actually take the credit for maybe the success of the team.
So I think this is interesting because the shot location thing does seem to be the major factor, which I think is quite funny. I don't know if you know Simon Benoob used to work for Opta. I think he's elsewhere in the industry now. He always says this is a multi-million pound industry that is basically telling teams that you should shoot from close to the goal rather than far from the goal, which I think is quite funny. But I'm interested to see, I mean, obviously we don't have the data, so by definition it's difficult to find. But if you look at the 1966 World Cup final, which obviously went to extra time, 120 minutes, there were 77 shots in there, which is remarkable. And obviously these weren't 77 clear-cut chances. They were pot shots from range. So I'm interested to see whether this has always been a kind of gradual curve coming down or whether it has, you know, really kicked into gear in the analytics era. And the other thing, I think set pieces is clearly the area where it's had a massive impact. The other bit, crossing, I think is interesting because the side who, from reading Rory's book, I think are probably most advanced is Liverpool in terms of the analytics side of things. A massive part of their success in recent years has been crossing. It's been from Robertson and Alexander-Arnold, who are getting assist numbers that no fullback has ever got before. And I think it's interesting there because, I mean, I think you say, Rory, Ian Graham didn't want to be interviewed for the book, but there must be some quite advanced work that's being done on where you cross from, how you cross from, and how you get players into the middle. I know Tom Warville, when he was still with us, did some interesting work of that. But it's those things that it strikes me that there's some fascinating insights about individual teams and how they play that we just haven't got the information with yet. So, I mean, that's why I think this book is interesting, because it's clearly happening. But I can't put my finger on precisely what is being done in data and what's being done on the pitch and what the link is between those two things.
Well, yeah, so you can't, it's really hard to separate. Is Liverpool's success, or the success it's had for the last 5-6 years on that right-hand side, say, is it because of a data-led insight that has told Jurgen Klopp to tell Trent Alexander-Arnold, this is where you cross from, roughly, and this is kind of where you're aiming to cross from, and this is where you're aiming to cross to? Is there an insight that has been, we need this number of bodies in the box? There was that period, I think, last season when Jota, who's about 3 feet tall, kept scoring headers. Now, is that because Jota has some sort of instinctive ability to not to suddenly get into the box and not be 5'5"? Or is it because he is being told, this is where you need to be, because this is where the ball is coming? My instinct is it's probably the latter, that it doesn't, stuff like that doesn't happen by chance. And you know that Liverpool worked very heavily on kind of the spatial layout of the team effectively, and that they have done a lot of work into that. They themselves would tell you that the bulk of their analytics work is still in recruitment. That is where the low-hanging fruit is. That's where the most value is, because that's your greatest outlay, that's your greatest cost. So that's where you don't devote resources. But at the same time, it might just be that Trent Alexander-Arnold is really, really good at delivering a ball, and that he has an instinctive ability to think, actually, do you know what, where I want to be is that area just outside the 18-yard box. That is where I get most joy. That's where the angles are right for me. Because ultimately, no matter how bright the people behind the scenes are and how insightful the data is and how kind of clean it is, you still need someone who has the right foot of Trent Alexander-Arnold to make that all work. I think that there's probably more teams than we realise who have made relatively minor tweaks to the way they play because of data, and don't necessarily want to. And I'd say Manchester City are probably one of them. That as much as everything at Man City is billed as kind of the great genius of Guardiola, and as much as the club kind of want that to be the narrative around everything that Man City do, you know, City complain every year that their players don't win individual awards. Well, if you'd managers taking all the credit, it's quite hard to be told that you're the player of the season, to be perfectly honest, as it's, or everything is Guardiola. But there's a massive data team at City, and I would be staggered if they hadn't said, even if it's simply this bit that you're doing isn't working, you don't need to pursue this idea, because it just doesn't have the output that you want. Or maybe, as Mark says, maybe you need to do that, but on the other side of the pitch, maybe that's more effective. I think that those changes are probably quite common. That there aren't massive shifts in how the game is played, because ultimately Liverpool and Man City still cross the ball. They do it slightly differently to how we used to cross the ball, but they still cross it. It's to do with where you're doing it from, or the nature of the cross, or the type of cross that you're putting in, or who's doing the crossing. You know, Liverpool are the first team that I can think of whose two great creative influences are fullbacks. I suspect there has been a data that in fact, with it being Liverpool, I'd be staggered if that's not been supported by data. They will have run that as an idea and seen how it worked. And I think those changes are probably fairly common across football. It's just that nobody wants to tell you.
It does feel, in terms of creative players and, let's say, assists, although as we have discussed many times on here, that is a particularly loud and somewhat old school statistic, even if in itself it's only been around for a few decades. Michael, it feels to me, not just at the elite level, but, you know, down in the EFL, the leagues I cover very closely, particularly down in League Two, we notice it quite a lot, that it's often the system now that creates the chances, really, whether that's a high press. And I wonder if we think that might have been influenced by data, teams pressing high and, you know, Klopp saying that the press itself is the best playmaker, rather than creative types, shall we say. Well, that guy's going to set up a load of goals this season. Quite often you realise the teams who are doing well, they don't have one person you can point to and say, he's creating all these chances from open play. It can be more about the system working.
Yeah, I think that is fair. And I think that probably, you can probably say the same about most concepts in football. I think the goal scoring is no longer just about one goal scorer. The defending is no longer just about the defenders. Yeah, I think it's become a more collective thing, certainly.
And what about the high press? And I'm going to bunch defending with a very high line in with that, because I think there's probably an extent to which a high press sort of pulls a line higher as well, naturally in the game. Do you think that's something that has increased and potentially due to insights gleaned from increased data use in football?
I don't know. Again, it's one of those things I expect probably is the case, but I don't know. Rory might have more insight on that.
I think with that one, the Jaden pressing game that comes out of Germany, I think probably wasn't driven by data. I think that was driven by personal taste and a kind of reaction to the traditional, quite stultifying German style. You get Ralf Rangnick, who kind of launches it into the German consciousness, and then develops kind of a school of coaches who kind of think like him. Wolfgang Wolf, I think, is the Wolfgang Frank, sorry, is the other one who Klopp credits with being his kind of his Yoda. So I don't think that comes out. That is too early for that to be supported by anything particularly sophisticated in terms of data. At Liverpool, the way the data has informed it is obviously that idea is Klopp's idea. He doesn't need the data to tell him that's the way that he thinks football should be played. I would say that data will have informed where that pressing is done, how many players follow the press, how the press is triggered, at what points the press is triggered. But what Mark says is absolutely right, that this isn't the case that kind of the players are going in on a Monday with a game on the Saturday and being told, you know, we've seen that 43% of the time in this quadrant, the player, you know, this player loses possession. It will be fed through several layers of information until it reaches Klopp and Pep Linders and whoever else on the coaching staff and is boiled down to a couple of sentences, which might be, you know, Wolves are vulnerable in the gap between the left centre half and the left back, and you need to press that. That's where they lose the ball. And that then changes the way that Klopp and his coaching staff train the press that week. Because most football clubs' weeks follow basically the same schedule, which is a day on set pieces, a day on what they do when they've got the ball, a day on what they do when they've not got the ball, a day off, and a kind of warm down analysis session of the previous week's game. That's kind of what the week is, and that's how it's laid out. So it's not that kind of there's big lectures being given to the players, because that'd be too much information for them to absorb, and it wouldn't mean anything to them anyway. That it's tweaking the way styles are coached and the way that a broader guiding principle is played. And we'll see this with Potter at Chelsea, that, you know, it's not an accident that Graham Potter's taken his analyst with him. He obviously likes the way that the game is the insights from previous games are presented to him, and he feels they're useful. But that will only inform almost the finer detail of his coaching. His guiding principles, which he puts up on a projector screen when he arrives at a club, they're always the same. They're not changing. The data just informs exactly how they should be implemented from case to case, I think.
I think as a general point, kind of off the back of that, from chatting with people who do work in clubs, they do speak about the importance of that kind of language within the training ground, and sort of touched upon it already, but very few would even say the words expected goals within the training ground. They'd say things like chance quality and things which we would often say, you know, in our writing that we do. And I think that it's a duty of care from the data team, all those analysts within the training ground, to be that communicator, or at least the translator from what is maybe a statistical model or a piece of analysis, and talk in that language of football. I think it's more of a general point to say that these people, you know, these analysts do have to be quite socially astute to not go in all guns blazing and try to think, okay, well, this data is actually more informative than what these tacticians are doing. A lot of people I've spoken to have said that it's a case of taking their time, building that trust with the coaching staff to show that you can add value first and foremost, and then you can start to kind of hopefully build some influence if indeed you can.
Have any of you seen Welcome to Wrexham?
Not yet.
So there's a great scene in, I think, the second episode where Humphrey Kerr, who's a comedian and a writer, and is the guy that Reynolds and McElhenney appoint to run, to kind of be their eyes and ears on the ground, where he introduces himself to the playing squad. And he's slightly Louis Theroux-y. That's the best way I can describe him. And he kind of says, oh, you know, I'm here. I'm kind of here for Rob and Ryan, just to, you know, to make sure that you guys are okay and that everything's going okay. And he's really nice. Like, in most industries, it would be like, well, he seems like quite a friendly man. He doesn't seem like an evil kind of capitalist. He'll be all right. And the looks on the faces of the players at this effectively nerd, like they're presented with this really quite nerdy, foppish comedian, and they're national league players. And there's the look of sheer, like, slight bemusement and bafflement, a little bit of genuine hatred. And then as he leaves, he kind of shambles out the door, and then the door closes and you just hear the laughter. That's how football treats outsiders. That anyone who's not of football gets that treatment within football.
But to go back to Mark's point about how you wouldn't hear expected goals, it kind of sums up the argument from 3 or 4 years ago that expected goals is a silly phrase, isn't it? Mm. It doesn't communicate to people who are outside analytics, economics, what you're trying to say. And chance quality or chance value has always made a lot more sense to me than expected goals, which prompts a lot of the arguments, like, you know.
Yeah, no, yeah.
The Craig Burley arguments against it, if that makes sense.
I get frustrated, as I say, as someone who's not kind of the same, that I don't understand the algorithms, I don't kind of have that background. But I find the objection to expected goals really bizarre, because it's such an intuitive thing to any football fan. It makes complete sense to you as a fan. But I think you're right. I think it's the name that people object to. And there is one of my golden rules in football is never name anything, because as soon as you name something, people will criticise it. So if you just describe it in sort of woolly terms and no one's quite sure what it is, then you're probably a lot safer. It's the same when Liverpool had a transfer committee. That's literally how every club runs. They just called it a transfer committee. So people went, ha, you've got a transfer committee. And it's the same with expected goals. The name, it makes sense when you kind of understand what it's measuring. But yeah, chance quality is probably is a much more kind of amenable term to fans, for those who don't want to necessarily accept the concept.
I mean, I would go as far as to say that essentially people have always talked about football in expected goals terms.
Yeah.
In the sense that if you say they got lucky or they deserve to win, or even after Napoli, Liverpool last week, people are saying, well, it could have been 6 or 7. I mean, the calculation in your mind there is you're basically starting with the goals that have been scored and kind of adding on the XG that wasn't scored to get to it could have been 6-0. But yeah, it's a good name for a book, I should say, just not a good name for the metric.
Must have been tough to come up with a title for someone who abhors naming things, Rory. That must have been probably the hardest.
I want it to be really long so that no one could criticise it. That would have been the easiest thing to do.
Mark, last one in the instalment of our quiz. Was it Pep or was it numbers? What might be called building up or build-up play, or if that's a term that wouldn't be enjoyed by outsiders, passing out from the back, I think it's probably the easiest way of describing it. I'm thinking about goalkeepers and goal kicks, particularly how we can measure the evolution, if you will, of that particular part of the game. But I suppose defenders and increased technical ability and punching passes through the lines being important. That feels like a part of the game that we have to touch on here.
Yeah, and I think it'll be the second, maybe third time we've cited Tom Warville here. But he did do a great talk, actually, going back a few years at the Opta Pro Analytics Forum. And I think there's a written piece off the back of it that basically showed, if you were to basically take a goal kick short, the advancement in the end of that sequence from the team in possession is actually further than if you were to go long, because obviously it's a bit more of a 50-50. You're more likely to lose possession. So it makes intuitive sense, but Tom did sort of show that, backed up by the numbers. Again, is it one of those where you were to have the data first and then say we need to implement this and start to go short from goal kicks, or, you know, reverse engineering it? I'm not too sure, but there is data to back up the idea that short goal kicks, you are more likely to advance and keep possession further up the field than if you go long or not short.
This is a thing that that only occurred to me after I finished writing the book, which is annoying. I think there is one other area where analytics has massively changed what happens on a football pitch, and that's goal kicks. If you look at the field at any goal kick where one team plays with something even vaguely approaching a press, it makes no sense. So if you play Sunday League, you have a goal kick. The four defenders, because it's always 4-4-2, or it certainly was until I hit my 40s and had to stop playing because I was too old, but you know, the four defenders will stand where the defenders stand, the midfielders stand will stand somewhere in the midfield, and the strikers will stand up front. That's how teams line up. And everyone kind of migrates towards the person who's supposed to be marking them, which is the fundamental difference between professional footballers and amateur footballers. If you watch a game now, there are six or seven players around the penalty area, defending the team with the ball, the team taking the goal kick, and the players who are waiting to press them. There is a massive field of green, and then there's the back line. And that is completely, if you'd shown that to a football fan 30 years ago, that would have made no sense to them whatsoever. They would have said, well, why is there no one in midfield? That is a huge change that has been led, and this is, again, chicken and egg, but has been led by the rise of the pressing game. Teams are now inviting the press. I was at Anfield last night where Ajax took their goal kicks backwards, which is something that's happening increasingly, that teams want to get a defender or a goalkeeper to play the ball further back so you can invite the press and then break through the lines earlier in your own half, because that then confers more space to operate your kind of counterpunch in. That has been led by the rise of the pressing game, which may or may not have an analytical source. But the reason it's happened, the counter action has happened, is because that's what the data tells them to do. That's a data-led insight into how you set up against the pressing team. That you are forcing them into areas. And data isn't just kind of raw figures on pass completion or whatever, a number of passes made, and it's not just kind of expected possession value, expected goals, whatever you want, chance quality. It's also looking at things like, what areas of the pitch do we want our opponents to be operating in? And I think that those sorts of insights are changing the way the game is played in very small but very significant ways. Goal kicks now are the best example. The next time you go to a game and watch a game on TV and get that wide shot, you'll see it. There is a massive hole in the middle of the pitch because nobody wants to be in midfield.
Yeah, it is remarkable at times, isn't it? And as I say, as someone who watches as much fourth tier football as Premier League football, it's added an extra layer onto watching the game, which I enjoy, but I also occasionally watch with my hands in front of my eyes. Michael, before we leave behind tactics, is there anything we're missing? What about tackling, you know, fouls, the way that players are taught to tackle now? Is that something that you think has changed a huge amount?
Again, kind of to repeat what I said to one of your earlier questions, I think it probably has changed, and I think it probably has changed because of data in part. I mean, there's the famous story about Yapstam and tackling that Rory has in the book. There's, you know, there's that famous Paolo Maldini quote about, you know, if I tackle, I've made a mistake. So I think people kind of know that those kind of active defensive metrics are not that valuable. But again, I don't see massively obvious or clear or very on the record answer from someone who knows more than me about precisely how that has happened. But again, Rory will probably have more insight than me on that.
I'm not sure. I think you're right that the kind of idea that tackles are a last resort, the famous, was it Pep who said tackles, what is tackles?
Yeah.
And there was that time that Xabi Alonso slagged off a kid in the Liverpool programme for saying that his strengths were tackling, and Xabi Alonso, that one of the football's nicest men, insulted a 17-year-old for saying, this is nonsense. That shouldn't be your strength. You're obviously rubbish. I don't know. To kind of repeat the same theme, the tactical foul, the concept of the tactical foul is now probably much more widespread as a kind of almost formal thing than it used to be. My guess is that, again, there will be a data insight into that, which is we need to not let them counter us because we're dangerous. We're vulnerable in moments of transition. So yeah, that yellow card is worth more to us than conceding a chance. I don't know to what extent that has been the broader kind of nature of tackling has changed, or kind of the frequency of tackling has changed because of data. Does ultimately players do make mistakes, however they've been told, however they've been trained, and whatever they've been told to do, and whatever that is, they'll make mistakes or they'll keep tackling. I don't think we've, Mark might have an insight into this, but I don't think we've noticed a particular decrease in tackling that can't be broadly attributed to the fact that it is slowly being outlawed.
Yeah, I don't think there is too much, but it's just making me think, because I did a piece fairly recently about maybe tactical fouling and fouling in general. And I think that this, the likes of Manchester City and Liverpool, they commit their tackles and their fouls to a certain extent higher up the field, which makes sense because they do have a higher line and it's more likely to occur. I don't know whether there's been any research done on it per se, but I think the incidence of yellow cards would be maybe lower on occasions where it almost looks a little bit too enthusiastic, a little bit too clumsy, because these teams are pressing quite quickly. That you think of the Fernandinho example, Rodri to a certain extent, Thiago's getting really good at it at Liverpool, where it just looks like they're over-eager. They break the attack of the opposition, even having a possibility to counter-attack, but it just looks a little bit like they are over-eager. I think it's a really interesting way to maybe look at it with data to show that you're less likely to actually get a yellow card if you shut it down really quickly. So keep doing those sorts of challenges. Obviously try and win the ball if you can, but there's maybe a greater affordance that you're not going to actually have a poor record in terms of yellow cards and discipline, but you are more like the advantage outweighs the disadvantage of really trying to make a quick foul or a quick tackle as soon as you can.
The other thing about the high line that I think is important is that, because obviously it's all uniforms, if you want to play a high press, you've got to play a high line, because otherwise everything, and we've seen this with Liverpool this season, that if the three units are too distinct, then it doesn't work. There's too much space. You can't press properly if there's lots of space. You need to make the pitch really small. So that may or may not be informed by data. But the one thing that the high line at Liverpool in particular has definitely been informed by is technology. So the reason that Klopp goes really high in whichever season it was,
2019, right?
Was the introduction of VAR. Because he figures they will now get the offsides right. And Max Allegri might tell you that they don't get the offsides right all the time, but they do, you know, as a rule, if you're offside, you're now offside. You're not kind of liable to the whims of the linesman being up to speed. So you can play a higher line safer in the knowledge that if, as long as you get it right, you will not be punished for it because of a mistake. And I think that is what kind of encourages Klopp, okay, we can maybe take two or three steps even further forward, really scrunch the game. And that is crucial as well, because a lot of the story of football and data in general is about technology. It's about the world being able to do the stuff that the data analysts, the people who are keen to kind of parse football in this way, want it to do. You can't do it with VHSs. You need DVDs. You can't do it when you don't have the internet. There's not a world in which football could adopt data in the 1970s, just the technology wasn't there. And I think that's the other factor that has maybe changed. I mean, Michael's book talks about the back pass in 1992 as being probably the greatest stylistic shift in certainly modern football and probably any football. The abolition of the back pass rule is a hugely significant event. And I think that the introduction of VAR may well have a more minor impact, but an impact nonetheless.
I think this is really interesting, because I must be able to, I mean, I'm not that interested in ownership of clubs or transfers. I find them, those factors, not particularly interesting, but I am fascinated by the rules and how the game changes. And I think it's very interesting you mentioned tactical fouling, Rory, and it maybe opens up another question about who's using the data. Obviously, you know, we know that people at clubs are using the data, but are the IFAB using data to work out kind of how football should be played and how the game should be regulated? Because a real bugbear of mine is tactical fouling, and the fact that the punishment for a tactical foul, a yellow card and a free kick in the centre of the pitch, doesn't anywhere near match the opportunity you have from the counter-attack. And for those of us who think there should be some stronger penalty, whether it's a sin bin, whether it's a free kick higher up the pitch, presumably, if you're clever, you can use data to show that actually you're going from a 10% risk of a goal to a 1% risk of a goal with that tactical foul, and maybe the rules of the game can be changed.
That had never occurred to me, but that's a really good point. Yeah, my guess is that IFAB definitely aren't using data and may not have computers. So I think it's hard to be certain. But yeah, that is precise. That is one of the things that you could use data for. and Mark would be better positioned than me to know what that is. But if you think of a team counter-attacking, conceding a that free kick in the middle of the pitch when it looks like they've got an overload, then their chance of scoring is being reduced by a significant factor. And you know, one of the problems with penalties is that if you give away a penalty in the corner of the box, you might be facing a 5% chance of conceding a goal, and suddenly you're presented with a penalty and you have an 85% chance of conceding a goal. That is a disproportionate punishment. But the same logic applies to tactical fouls, that if you're robbing a team of a 50% chance of having a shot on goal at least in a favour of a kind of 1%, because suddenly everyone's set again and it's a free kick, that is not in the interest of the sport. There's a disproportionate reward for that foul. So maybe that should be looked at, yeah.
Lots of really interesting aspects to this discussion. We could do a whole nother hour on its impact in the recruitment side of the game. We're not going to do that. I'm going to frame it as because Michael has demanded that we don't talk about transfers. It's not actually the reason. Just to finish off, going to sort of zoom out a little bit and ask some more, I don't know if they're philosophical questions, it's probably the wrong word to use. But Rory, one of the sentences, one of the conclusions, or I guess reflections of the book that really stood out to me was, and this is a quote from the book, "Even the most positive analysts feel all football has done is clear the lowest bar possible." Now, of course, in the wider scheme of the sport, this is still a new thing, in inverted commas. But, you know, reading your book, there are a lot of people, very smart people, who have actually sunk quite a lot of time into using numbers and data in football. So we might be 15 years in, let's say, to the real pioneers. Why do you think that people feel that all football's done is clear the lowest bar possible?
Yeah, it's hard to say this as someone who kind of is talking to people and basically asking them, what's your experience? And then they, you know, recount their experience. Mm. And then you say, I think you've got it wrong. Mm-hmm. I think people who worked within analytics, within football, are a bit too negative about the progress they've made. I think that they've come a lot further than they realise. And there's like a human tendency, I guess, towards impatience, to not understand, not accepting the idea that change has to happen incrementally, that, you know, it's easy now to scoff at some of the things that were done. Someone like Damien Comolli, a lot of the kind of analytics fundamentalists who Mark talks to will laugh at Damien Comolli and regard him as kind of even worse than a non-believer, like a heretic, someone who did it but got it wrong. But you need Comolli figures. You have to have them, because they have to act as bridges between eras. So you probably can't get to a world where kind of they talk about PPDA on Match of the Day 2 without Damien Comolli, or at least people like him who were willing to kind of engage with it in a broader brush kind of way, even if some of the conclusions he reached were too simplistic or kind of got the wrong end of the stick, which undoubtedly happened. But you need to go through those teething problems, I guess, to get anywhere. So I think to some extent they don't there's not necessarily an appreciation for how far they've come and in how short a time. I think you can make a case, as I think I do in the book, that football's actually adopted analytics far quicker than baseball did, which feels really counterintuitive. But there's still plenty of teams in baseball who have no interest in analytics whatsoever. And even that, you know, there's Bill James and sabermetrics comes along in the 1970s, and it's 2003 that the A's kind of internalize it and start to use it in some way properly. It's 25 years. Football's a little bit quicker, not by much, but a little bit quicker and a lot more widespread. Mm. And even if the findings aren't quite as sophisticated. So I think there's a degree of humility maybe, and it's maybe testament to the frustration they felt at times that they don't really necessarily realise how quick it's been and how far they've come. But also I think there is a sense, as we touched on at the start, that they know there's a lot more that can be done. That this is the end of the beginning, that they've maybe won the broad argument, and now there is an arms race to find out who can do what with all of this data. And that lead, you know, that kind of battle is played out in terms of getting access to what they call broadcast tracking data, which means you can look at games and analyze them properly just from the TV feeds. AI, I think, will play a part in that, as everyone keeps predicting it will in everything. I suppose at some point someone's going to use the word metaverse. I don't know what that means, but that will be something that they talk about without a shadow of a doubt. And there will be more kind of stylistic imprints, that there will be things that they discover almost by accident sometimes and sometimes on purpose, that make them think, okay, maybe we should do this differently. Maybe there is a way to approach this in a way that we haven't thought of before. And sometimes that will probably look like kind of an almost like nostalgic retro step to doing something that has always been the case, but just doing it in a slightly more scientific, slightly more focused way. I think that is the other sense, that there's a lot more to come. And when you see, I guess when you see this whole kind of landscape opening up in front of you, waiting to be coloured in, you're less inclined to think that you've done much more than a corner of it.
Well, it's been a fascinating discussion, and lots of the things that we've touched on with Rory today will be part of our conversations, no doubt, on this podcast in the short term, and of course the mid to long term. This is stuff that we will be covering as best we can, tracking, if you will, on the Athletic Football Tactics podcast until they tell us otherwise. I'll leave you, the listener, with two suggestions. The first one is to buy Rory Smith's book, Expected Goals, The Story of How Data Conquered Football and Changed the Game Forever. The second, which you'll see coming, is to read The Athletic, read Michael's piece about his holiday in Spain, read everything that Mark is writing, both individually and co-writing with an array of fantastic writers. And if you're not a subscriber of The Athletic, but you'd like to be today, then head to theathletic.co.uk/tactics. It's been a pleasure to have the best seat in the house, listening to Rory, to Michael, to Mark. Huge thank you to all three of them. And get in touch with us on Twitter. You can also comment on this episode on the Athletic app. You'll find a page where this episode is embedded. You can leave your comments, requests, of course, any suggestions for future topics. We'd love to hear from you. And we'll talk to you again next week on the Athletic Football Tactics podcast.
The Athletic.